This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Tuesday, June the 9th, 2026. As always, we're going to start in the world section of today's monitor and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, to start us off, our first headline from the world section of today's monitor reads, "Is Latin America shifting to the political right? Peru may offer another story." Many predicted a rightward shift in Peru's presidential runoff, but the results are so close it could take days, possibly weeks, to declare a winner. The date on this article is June 8th. It is by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. The lead in Peru's statistically tied presidential election swung from right to left Monday, leaving the country facing days, if not weeks, of uncertainty before a winner is declared. Right-wing candidate Keiko Fujimori held an ultra-slim advantage Monday morning, but by the afternoon, leftist candidate Roberto Sanchez had eked out a minuscule lead, 0.2 percentage point, with 94% of the votes counted. Election officials foresee additional moves in the top spot as final votes roll in. Much clearer is what the virtual 50-50 tie between Mr. Fujimori and Mr. Sanchez says about Peru's political landscape and Latin America more broadly. More than the rightward shift that some in Peru had predicted, the results underscore a deeply polarized electorate and an enduring right-left political divide. In Peru's case, that bitter standoff has been an underlying factor in the political instability that has given the country 9 presidents in 10 years. The preliminary results of Sunday's runoff election are nearly identical to those of Peru's 2021 contest. In that vote, leftist Pedro Castillo, Mr. Sanchez's political mentor, bested Ms. Fujimori by less than 1 percentage point. Ms. Fujimori's political party, Popular Force, went on to play a pivotal role in Mr. Castillo's removal from office in December 2022. The results in Peru might also suggest a hardening and tightening right-left divide across the region. Ahead of Sunday's runoff, observers predicted that Peru was about to join other Latin American countries from Chile to Ecuador in a rightward political shift. But the results don't confirm that. If anything, they more closely mirror elections such as those in Honduras, where only after weeks of ballot counting and recounting and accusations of fraud following last year's vote was the conservative candidate Nasri Asfura declared the winner. Peru's election might also prove to be a bellwether for how the wider region navigates the challenging international atmosphere created by U.S. President Donald Trump. His aggressive Donroe Doctrine proclaims American dominance in the hemisphere and demands that brakes be applied to China's growing regional influence. Mr. Sanchez, who served as Trade and Tourism Minister under President Castillo, offered assurances during the campaign that, under his leadership, Peru would continue to welcome business and investment relationships with all global trade powers. He avoided demonizing Mr. Trump or promoting the growing anti-Yankee sentiments within some of his allied leftist groups. At the same time, Ms. Fujimori, widely seen as the more business-friendly of the two contenders, underscored in her campaign that she would maintain an open door to all investors and powers. Neither is likely to turn their back on China as a major trading partner, nor embrace the more hostile elements of Trump's Latin American and immigration policy, says Cynthia Sanborn, director of the Center for China and the Asia Pacific at Peru's Universidad del Pacífico, in a post-election commentary for America's Quarterly. Both focus on Peru being a hub to the Pacific, she said. Indeed, Ms. Fujimori's apparent refusal to take sides in the U.S.-China rivalry in her country and the region might explain why Mr. Trump did not endorse her, as he did Mr. Asfura in Honduras and other right-wing candidates in recent Latin American elections. If Ms. Fujimori ultimately wins the presidency, it would be a remarkable capstone to a political career that has kept her in the limelight for decades. In 1994, she began serving as Peru's first lady after her father, President Alberto Fujimori, offered her the job when she was just 19 years old. Sunday's election marked Ms. Fujimori's fourth try at following in her disgraced father's footsteps. Early in the campaign, Ms. Fujimori was seen as distancing herself from her father's controversial rule. Mr. Fujimori is credited with defeating Peru's virulent terrorism of the 1990s, but is also disdained for turning increasingly dictatorial and corrupt. But as public opinion surveys showed voters listing crime, public order, and political instability as their top issues, in recent weeks, Ms. Fujimori shifted to a full embrace of her father's anti-terrorism mantle. It might turn out to be the shift that brought Keiko Fujimori back to the presidential palace that once, as First Lady, she had painted pink. Or maybe she won't return there at all. And again, this particular article was by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving right along to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor. This one reads, "More important than food, extreme heat is shifting how Indians think about AC." As heat waves intensify across India, air conditioners are shifting from a luxury to a necessity, giving rise to a new AC rental market in major cities. The date on this article is June the 8th. It is by Akash Hassan, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and the dateline is New Delhi. By the first week of April, Mohammed Asif could no longer sleep. The ceiling fan in his rented room in Delhi whirred through the night, pushing hot air from one corner of the room to another. Even after midnight, the heat lingered. Mr. Asif moved from Kashmir's cool mountain valleys to India's capital 7 months ago to take up a government job in the education department. He arrived after summer had passed and assumed he could manage the next one with a fan. Then temperatures began to climb. "People had warned me about Delhi summers, but I thought I could manage," he says. "Once the heat set in, it became unbearable." As an air conditioner was not in his budget, much of his income goes toward supporting his wife, infant daughter, and parents still living in Kashmir, and the cheapest unit would cost nearly a month's salary. But as the heat intensified, he felt he had little choice. He took out a loan and bought an air conditioner for 30,000 rupees, or about $314. "It didn't feel like a luxury purpose," he said. "It felt like a necessity." Across India, millions of households are reaching the same conclusion. As heat waves become more frequent and intense across South Asia, air conditioners are rapidly shifting from aspirational consumer goods to essential tools for coping with daily life. Yet access remains deeply unequal. While AC ownership is rising, only about 8 to 10% of India's roughly 300 million households currently own an air conditioner, leaving hundreds of millions of people exposed to dangerous heat or turning to a fast-growing AC rental market. "This trend exposes a deep cooling apartheid in India," says Harjeet Singh, founding director of Satat Sampada Climate Foundation, an advocacy organization based in Delhi. "While affluent households run multiple units without a second thought, poorer families are pushed into debt cycles just to keep a single room livable." The need for cooling is becoming harder to ignore. Temperatures in Delhi and surrounding states have already touched 46 degrees Celsius, or 114.8 degrees Fahrenheit this year, according to government data. In recent years, parts of neighboring Rajasthan have recorded temperatures above 50 degrees Celsius, which is 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Scientists also warn that densely built cities are trapping heat after sunset, leading to increasingly hot nights and offering little relief after scorching days. On the hottest days, Asad Khan's workshop in the South Delhi neighborhood of Abdul Fazal grows crowded. Technicians weave between stacks of air conditioners, their phones ringing with constant requests for rentals, servicing, and emergency repairs. Mr. Khan started his air conditioner repair business about 25 years ago. As demand for cooling grew, he began refurbishing older units and renting them out, starting with just two machines. Today, he rents out more than 150. Every summer is busier than the last, he says. If I had more units and more technicians, I could easily rent out hundreds more. The climbing heat has also changed the nature of Mr. Khan's business. Air conditioners are running for longer hours and under greater strain, leading to more breakdowns and repair calls during the peak summer months. The hotter it gets, the harder these machines have to work, he says. We're fixing far more units than we used to. Across Delhi, hundreds of rental businesses now offer seasonal air conditioners, typically charging between 7,000 and 15,000 rupees, and that would be $73 to $157 for the summer, including installation and servicing. Many of our customers simply can't afford to buy a new AC, Mr. Khan says. For them, renting is the only way to get through the summer. Air conditioners save lives, but not without a cost. While cooling Indian homes, the rattling window units rented out in shops across Delhi also release heat into the surrounding environment and place growing pressure on electricity networks. According to the International Energy Agency, India could have more than 1 billion air conditioners in operation by 2050, up from fewer than 50 million in 2020. The agency estimates that every 1 degree Celsius rise in the outdoor temperature was associated with roughly a 7 gigawatt increase in India's peak electricity demand in 2024. India is caught in a classic tragic climate paradox, says Mr. Singh, who made headlines in January after being detained for his climate activism. We are largely using fossil-fueled power energy to cool ourselves from the very warming that burning fossil fuels has caused. Breaking the cycle will require cleaning up the power grid and rethinking urban design. In the meantime, we cannot tell a family suffering in 47 degrees Celsius, 116.6 degrees Fahrenheit, heat that they shouldn't buy an AC because of emissions, he adds. For 90% of Indians who work in the informal sector, air conditioning is becoming an essential tool to earning a living. Standing beside his mobile sugarcane juice cart on a busy roadside in Haryana, 18-year-old Subit Kumar feeds cane stalks into a noisy crushing machine as hot winds sweep across the highway. Last summer, he realized that if he wanted to keep working through the region's dizzying heat, he needed an air conditioner at home. Unable to afford one on his own, he pooled money with his uncle and rented a unit for 8,000 rupees, that's $83, for the season. Today, Mr. Kumar's family and his uncle's family, 8 people in all, sleep in a single 10-by-12-foot room where the air conditioner is installed. To stand here all day in this heat, I need at least 6 or 7 hours of sleep, he says, over the roar of the crushing machine. Without the AC, that wasn't possible. Mr. Kumar, who has been helping support his family since he was 12, no longer views air conditioning as a luxury. These days, it feels more important than food, he says. And again, this particular article was by Akash Hassan, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Continuing on in the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, after another round of retaliation, Iran and Israel say they will hold off for now. Iran fired a barrage of missiles directly at Israel in response to the Israeli military's latest attacks against Hezbollah in Beirut. Both sides quickly said they're willing to hold their fire for now. The date on this article is June 8th. It is by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and Shoshana Solomon, who is a special contributor at The Monitor. The datelines are London and Tel Aviv, Israel. Iran and Israel renewed exchanges of direct fire overnight Sunday, effectively disrupting a fragile 2-month ceasefire declared by President Donald Trump and risking a return to full-blown war. The complex chain of tit-for-tat military actions in Lebanon and then between Iran and Israel presented another challenge for Mr. Trump, who repeated his claim on Sunday that a peace deal was within reach. It also underscored how Iran is seeking to reshape regional dynamics to its advantage and ensure a comprehensive regional ceasefire that protects its strategic ally, Hezbollah, in Lebanon, and that is not vulnerable to what it considers frequent Israeli and American violations. By mid-afternoon Monday in Iran, the top military command headquarters, Khatam al-Anbiya, announced a cessation of operations. But it also warned that if Israeli attacks continue, including in southern Lebanon, then Iran's response will be more severe. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu later said in a statement that he would hold fire against Iran, but warned that Israel would respond powerfully if Iran made a mistake and resumed attacks. Meanwhile, Israelis raced to bomb shelters late Sunday when Iran launched an initial volley of ballistic missiles just hours after Israel expanded its attack against Hezbollah in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Iranian officials had warned that such a step by Israel would trigger an Iranian response after weeks of Israeli occupation and fighting with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, despite a nominal ceasefire brokered by the United States. Israel retaliated with airstrikes in Tehran and several other cities, defying Mr. Trump's call to hold its fire in response to Iran's barrage. The U.S. president said Sunday he was just days away from a negotiated end to the war against Iran, which the U.S. started jointly with Israel on February 28th. Among Israel's latest targets was Iran's petrochemical complex at Mashar, in the southwest region of the country. The Israel Defense Forces, which said its owned Sunday strikes on Beirut's southern suburb of Dahiye, were a response to earlier Hezbollah attacks on northern Israel, and stated that it would not allow Iran to create a new equation by responding directly to Israeli attacks in Lebanon. The IDF said it would continue to operate throughout Lebanon and will intensify its actions against Hezbollah. Analysts say the recent strikes by Iran against Israel aim to codify claims by Iranian officials that Lebanon and the fate of its Hezbollah ally must be treated as part of the Islamic Republic's broader conflict with the U.S. and Israel. This includes issues from Iran's nuclear program to its control over the Strait of Hormuz. Tehran's decision to answer a strike on Lebanon with missiles launched from its own soil is the operative development here, says Hamid Reza Azizi, an Iranian security expert at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, in an analysis on X. That decision gives concrete form to Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi's earlier formulation that the ceasefire applies on all fronts and that its violation on one front is a violation on all. For weeks, this remained a rhetorical position, but Sunday, Tehran attached a cost to it. The choice of instrument matters as much as the decision to act. Iran responded directly with its own missiles rather than through Hezbollah or other members of the Axis of Resistance, wrote Dr. Azizi. This continues a pattern that has defined the war. As the regional network has thinned, the missile force has become Tehran's primary tool for direct retaliation and coercive signaling. In Israel, where Mr. Netanyahu faces an election in October, the decision to retaliate against Iran was striking after Mr. Trump publicly stated before a phone call with Mr. Netanyahu that he was against any Israeli counterattack. "I call all the shots," the Financial Times newspaper quoted Mr. Trump saying about Mr. Netanyahu. "He doesn't call the shots." Since the middle of last year, Mr. Trump has reportedly called on Mr. Netanyahu to rein in some Israeli military operations from Iran to Lebanon if they appeared likely to jeopardize the president's own truce efforts. Despite Mr. Trump's public statements, Israeli retaliation was probably coordinated to an extent with the U.S., says Daniel Sobelman, assistant professor of international relations at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. I don't think that Netanyahu would have just flat-out defied Trump, he says. What Iran is trying to do is safeguard Hezbollah and restrict Israel's latitude in Lebanon vis-a-vis Hezbollah, says Dr. Sobelman. Even if we were not on the eve of this crucial election cycle, then it would be very important for any prime minister in Israel to prevent the Iranians from establishing these new rules of the game, whereby every time Israel exceeds a certain level of escalation or behaves in a manner that Iran sees as a violation of rules, that Iran retaliates with ballistic missiles. Schools in Israel were closed on Monday. Hospitals entered emergency mode, with many patients moved underground. Israelis were told to follow instructions from civil defense authorities regarding staying close to and entering safe rooms. In Iran, the Iranian barrages were cast in terms broader than Lebanon. Mohammed Bakar Kalibaf, the Speaker of Parliament and main liaison during current indirect talks with the U.S., stated on social media that the American naval blockade of Iran, quote, the violation of agreements regarding Lebanon, and the U.S. green light Sunday for Israel's Beirut attacks had turned U.S. and Israeli assets into legitimate targets. This is Iran trying to establish the rules that we are going to see in the next few months or few years, Fawad Izadi, a professor with close ties to the government at the University of Tehran, told the BBC. You cannot have Israel sabotaging the negotiations. This is obviously what Israelis are trying to do, says Dr. Izadi. We were supposed to have an agreement on Monday, according to Trump, and just a few days before that, they started hitting Beirut, knowing that this was a serious violation of the ceasefire that we were supposed to have. The aim of the strike is to tell the other side that Iranians are not fools, he said. Hardliners now hold the reins in Iran after Israeli strikes in the first salvos of the war killed Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He was replaced by his son, Mojtaba Khamenei, who reportedly suffered severe injuries in the same attack that killed his father, as well as the top echelon of leaders and commanders. These hardliners have also argued that the military must continue attacks against Israel and U.S. forces to reestablish deterrence that would prevent further attacks. Likewise, many in Israel argue that with regime change in Iran unachieved and Iran's nuclear missile and regional ally network still not fully destroyed, fighting should continue. The ceasefire declared by the U.S. on April 8th, after 40 days of conflict, was a major mistake, and the current escalation is a chance to delete and correct what we have done before, Oded Eilam, a former head of counterterrorism for Mossad and now a researcher at the Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs, told reporters Monday. Israel cannot do anything in Iran without consulting the Big Brother, which is America. Everything is coordinated with CENTCOM, says Mr. Aylam, referring to U.S. Central Command. In a way, it serves the Americans because the negotiations are right now at a stalemate, and this can be a leverage of the Americans, he says. The U.S., added Mr. Aylam, will leave it to the Israelis, and they will surely arrive after one day or two, as the schoolmaster saying, kids, enough is enough. We're going back to the negotiating table. And once again, this particular article was by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and Shoshana Solomon, who is a special contributor at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move along to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick up our first headline, which reads, as World Cup nears, controversies over ticket prices, team, and fan access still swirl. Between sky-high ticket prices, combatant competitors, and immigration enforcement worries, World Cup 2026 seems to have more than its fair share of issues. The date on this article is June 8th, and it is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, as well as Sarah Matusik, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. The World Cup is the unquestioned king of sport, with more viewership and more revenue than any other sporting event on the planet. and it's not even close. Sorry, Summer Olympics. With that comes fascination, scrutiny, and yes, always some sprinkling of controversy. Here are three of the biggest off-the-pitch storylines of this World Cup. Keep an eye out for our other World Cup explainer, which looks at why this edition is unlike any other in the history of competition. So, the first storyline would be the ticket prices are skyrocketing. Honestly, when was the last time anyone was happy about ticket prices? But even by the often absurd economics of American sports, the tickets for this World Cup are shaping up to be an eye-watering exercise. The attorneys general of New York and New Jersey have even opened an investigation. Where to start? First, there's the prices themselves. The most expensive block of tickets to the 2022 World Cup final were $1,600. For this year's final, they were $6,730. And that was just the beginning. Since then, they've gone up. By April, those tickets were selling for $10,990, according to NPR. As tickets are sold and resold, those numbers increase further and dramatically. As of April, ESPN found 4 tickets to the final, selling on the official site of the organizing body FIFA for $2,299,998.85 each. If you'd like to bid, please make sure you have those 85 cents. An analysis by NBC News found that the lowest average ticket prices were in Miami, $276, with the highest in New York, $1,399. And who even knows what seats you'll be getting? FIFA sells tickets only in general zones, then assigns the seat later. But reports suggest FIFA has been changing the size and locations of zones so buyers could be paying Category 1 prices for seats that when they bought them were in Category 2. FIFA President Gianni Infantino says this is just a part of the North American market, which is partly true. Tickets for American sports are more expensive than in other countries. But critics say a line has been crossed. No one should be manipulated into paying sky-high prices for seats, and fans should be able to trust that the tickets they purchase will be the ones they receive, said New York Attorney General Letitia James in a statement. So issue number 2, we'll be hearing more about, is will Iran be able to play in the U.S.? Nobody knows what the state of the U.S. war with Iran will be when the World Cup starts on June 11th. So what does that mean for the Iranian team? President Donald Trump initially said that Iran should not play, citing their own life and safety. But Mr. Infantino had insisted that they will, and Mr. Trump eventually conceded. Gianni is fantastic. He's a friend of mine. He talked about it. I said, you do what you want, he said at a press conference in April. The original plan was for the team to be based in Tucson, Arizona, but Iranian officials have since said they will train in Tijuana, Mexico, even though all 3 of their opening round games are in the United States. 2 will be in Los Angeles and 1 in Seattle. The delegation will be watched closely, Secretary of State Marco Rubio told a congressional hearing. We have no problem with the athletes, as we stated earlier, or their support staff, he said. But what we're not going to allow is for them to embed in their delegation a bunch of people that we know have nothing to do with athletics and have ties to the IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or things of that nature. Relatedly, an Iraqi player was detained for 7 hours and an Iraqi photographer was denied entry to the U.S. when the Iraqi national team arrived in Chicago on June 5th. ABC News reports that a Customs and Border Protection spokesperson said the photographer was inadmissible due to classified information in accordance with U.S. laws. Amid war in Iran, its national team has been training in Turkey in recent months. They will play New Zealand, Belgium, and Egypt in the first round. If both Iran and the U.S. finish second in their groups, they would play each other in the knockout round of 32. Issue number 3. Will immigration enforcement be on patrol? With support for its immigration policy waning ahead of the midterms, the Trump administration has scaled back high-profile street arrests. Even so, tensions remain leading up to the World Cup, with some stadium workers concerned about the presence of immigration officers. While immigration and customs enforcement will have a presence, officers won't round up non-citizens en masse, says Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen. Still, criminal investigators at ICE may pursue crimes like counterfeit ticketing and sex trafficking tied to the event. The arrival of millions of World Cup fans departs from the hard limits on who the administration typically lets in. Due to concerns about vetting, people from places such as Haiti and Iran are currently under a travel ban, though their teams have qualified to play. Separately, however, the State Department has waived a visa bond requirement for athletes and certain ticket holders to attend the games. Questions still hang over air travel. To punish, quote, sanctuary cities that limit aid to ICE, Secretary Mullen has considered scaling back customs officials at those cities' international airports. Critics say that plan would spell catastrophe for travel in red and blue states alike. And once again, this particular article was written by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, and Sarah Matusik, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving right along to our second headline from today's USA section of The Monitor, this one reads, California is still counting votes from June 2nd. Is distrust in elections the result? Election officials chalk up the delay to the large number of ballots cast by mail and the extra time it takes to verify them. But some experts say the slow count can further undermine trust in elections. The date on this article is June 8th. It is by Sophie Hills, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is San Diego. California's primary was June 2, yet voters are still waiting on the official results for most races, including high-profile contests for governor and Los Angeles mayor. That's become typical in the Golden State, where it now often takes days or even weeks for counties to tally races. Election officials here chalk up the delay in part to the large number of ballots being cast by mail and the extra time it takes to verify them. Some election experts say the slow count can further undermine trust in elections, and President Donald Trump is among critics who are already trying to cast doubt on California's process. This week, Californians may get some answers as the last remaining ballots trickle in. As of Monday morning, about 72% of the votes in the governor's race had been counted. Democrat Xavier Becerra is in the lead and will advance to the fall election, with Republican Steve Hilton and Democrat Tom Steyer in contention for the second slot. In Los Angeles, Mayor Karen Bass has also passed the threshold to advance. With around 83% of that vote counted, progressive Democrat Nithya Raman has taken a narrow lead over Republican candidate Spencer Pratt. So why does it take California so long to count votes? Many voters seem to like the convenience of mail ballots, yet they take longer to count. Prolonged tallying is a common issue in the state, in the states where electorates rely more heavily on voting by mail, something California began shifting toward just before the pandemic, says Thad Kusser, co-director of the Center for Transparent and Trusted Elections at the University of California, San Diego. Mail ballots in California are eligible to be counted as long as they are postmarked by Election Day and arrive within 7 days of the election, which means counties will still be accepting ballots through June 9th. Officials say those late arriving ballots are basically a trickle, with the majority of votes cast on Election Day or before. But even mail ballots that arrive well before Election Day take longer to count, When someone votes in person at a polling place, the vote can be verified then and there. Mail ballots take longer to verify, and all must go through the same process, whether they're delivered via a drop box or the U.S. Postal Service or dropped off at a polling place. California is one of 8 states that allow elections to be conducted entirely by mail, and every registered voter receives a mail ballot. That's really the factor behind the slow count, says Catherine Campos, a spokesperson for the Yolo County Elections Office. We, of course, wish that we could certify elections earlier, she says. Public frustration over the delay stems from a lack of understanding of all that goes into verifying vote-by-mail ballots, she adds. By June 5th, Ms. Campos says, Yolo County had processed around 30,000 ballots and still had 31,000 to go, along with any others that arrived by June 9th. To verify a mail ballot, officials must compare the voter's signature to what the county has on file. If the signatures don't match or there's no signature in their database, elections officials must notify the voter, who then has an opportunity to verify their signature. It's this huge crush of ballots that comes on Sunday, Monday, and on Tuesday that all need to go through this separate process to safeguard the integrity of the election, says Professor Kusser. But could officials speed up the count? In May, California Governor Gavin Newsom sent a letter to state election officials urging them to do all they can to tabulate votes quickly and accurately, adding, "Time is of the essence in preventing election lies from taking hold." In the letter, the governor pointed to 2025 state legislation aimed at allowing ballots to be processed sooner. They could already be processed as early as 29 days ahead of Election Day. But many mail ballots don't arrive until close to Election Day, and local election officials say their timeline is almost entirely dictated by regulations around careful processing of mail ballots, which are set by state legislators. In Butte County, which has around 127,000 registered voters, nearly all of the 41,000 votes cast in last week's election were mailed ballots. Everybody voted by mail except for two voters who cast what we would call a live ballot, which is the old-school polling place model. And then we had about 500 vote provisionally, says Keaton Denley, the registrar of voters in Butte County. Provisional ballots are used when there is a question about eligibility to be resolved or when voters miss the registration deadline. Mr. Denley says election workers often get unfairly maligned for being slow to count when really they're just following California law, something he wishes state officials would make clear. The state doesn't come out and say, here's why we take longer. It's on purpose to protect votes, he says. It sure would be nice if the state would stand behind their policies. Like other election officials, Mr. Denley does outreach in his county to try to help voters understand the process, meeting with local groups and running voter education workshops. More funding for those types of activities would be a welcome resource, he says. So, does a slow count undermine trust in the process? The longer it takes to call a race, the further voter confidence falls and the more conspiracies grow, says Professor Kusser. So, while the slowness of the count could actually reflect a careful process designed to prevent fraud, clearly there is a cost in terms of trust. That's even truer when the projected winner shifts as late votes get counted. In general, votes counted after Election Day tend to skew Democratic, partly because Democrats choose to vote by mail in higher numbers than Republicans do. In this year's gubernatorial primary, a crowded Democratic field that for months had lacked an obvious frontrunner caused many Democratic voters to hold on to their mail ballots for longer than usual before casting their votes. Mr. Trump, a critic of mail ballots, has already cast doubt on the integrity of California's election results, telling reporters in the Oval Office on June 4th that, quote, they're rigging the election. Separately, the U.S. Supreme Court is considering a Mississippi case that could result in barring states from accepting ballots that arrive after Election Day. In Yolo County, Ms. Campos says election officials have tried to counter public distrust by inviting voters to visit their facilities to learn about the process and observe it firsthand. Tours like that, along with explanatory videos, have boosted trust in the process in other states as well. Other California election officials say much of the criticism and pressure to speed things up has been coming from outside the state. It's the national conversation that gets built up into this frothing mess, says Mr. Denley. Talk to the average reasonable person, and they trust their local government for the most part. And once again, this particular article was written by Sophie Hills, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. Still in the USA section, our next headline reads, "Will Lindsey Graham face a runoff because of his Iran war support?" The South Carolina Republican is a powerful incumbent, but his promotion of the Iran war appears to be taking a toll with voters, raising doubts about whether he'll surpass the 50% needed to avoid a runoff in Tuesday's GOP primary. So that would be today. Interesting to watch. The date on this particular article is June 8th. It is by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. And the dateline is Fort Mill, South Carolina. One by one, the Republican candidates walk to the front of a cavernous church to address a mostly elderly group of voters gathered on a midweek evening in this solidly conservative corner of South Carolina. Senator Lindsey Graham, the four-term GOP incumbent they're hoping to unseat, is not among them. A longtime fixture of South Carolina politics and a golfing buddy of President Donald Trump, Mr. Graham has not faced a serious primary threat in years. Lately, however, there have been faint flashes of discontent. Senator Graham has been one of the most dogged and high-profile advocates for the U.S.-Israel war against Iran, which polls show has grown increasingly unpopular, even among Republicans. A poll conducted late last month by the Citadel raised some eyebrows when it showed Mr. Graham falling short of the 50% needed in the June 9th primary vote to avoid a runoff. To be clear, Mr. Graham is on track to win re-election, probably handily, as the chair of the powerful Senate Budget Committee with close ties to the president as well as power brokers in South Carolina. He can point to a long track record of delivering for his state. Though he gets lower approval ratings than other major Republican office holders here, his incumbency is a powerful and self-reinforcing factor. Beverly Heiss, a retired business owner who went to see the other GOP candidates at the forum in Fort Mill, says she's not really fond of Mr. Graham, but admits she's likely to wind up voting for him anyway. He's a shoe-in, Ms. Heiss says. Mr. Graham's political longevity is in many ways testament to his adaptive brand of conservatism. Once seen as a problem solver who worked with Democrats on immigration reform during the Obama administration, he has pivoted during the Trump era toward a more pugnacious populism and was rewarded with a place in Mr. Trump's inner circle. He even finessed the fallout from Mr. Trump's feud with Senator John McCain of Arizona, who was considered a maverick among Republicans and had been Mr. Graham's mentor and friend in the Senate before his death in 2018. He knows what way the political wind blows, says Scott Huffman, a political scientist who runs the Center for Public Opinion and Policy Research at Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina. People say, oh, we need to get Lindsey Graham out, but he always ends up in the right place at the right time. On the Iran war, though, Mr. Graham early on staked out a prominent and uncompromising position, making the case on television and on social media and doubling down even as the military mission appeared to stall. Indeed, he is more closely identified with the conflict than perhaps any other lawmaker in Washington, having boasted about his role in convincing Mr. Trump to go to war. As a result, any dip in Mr. Graham's own political support might be an indicator of how voters are feeling about the war and the resulting run-up in the price of gas and other staples in deep red states where two-thirds of adults say groceries are difficult to afford. And Also, Mark Lynch stages a challenge. Of the five Republicans running against Mr. Graham, four are polling in the single digit. Another candidate, attorney and Project 2025 architect Paul Dans, dropped out of the race in April after failing to gain much traction. The closest remaining challenger, Mark Lynch, was 10 percentage points behind Mr. Graham, 46% to 36% in the Citadel poll, and even further behind in a May poll by the Trafalgar Group, 52% to 28%. If no candidate receives more than half the votes cast, the primary will proceed to a runoff. Mr. Lynch, who owns an appliance store in Greenville, is financing his campaign with $5 million from he and his wife's retirement fund. He says Mr. Graham's voting record shows he isn't a true conservative, that as Budget Committee Chair, Mr. Graham failed to rein in deficit spending while advocating for raising the eligibility age for Social Security benefits. Mr. Graham's campaign has highlighted his role in passing Mr. Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, which eliminated taxes on Social Security for most seniors. But Mr. Lynch's sharpest attacks are aimed at Mr. Graham's hawkish foreign policy positions and his support for Israel. Conservatives in South Carolina generally supported Mr. Trump's decision to strike Iran in order to prevent it from developing a nuclear weapon. But many are growing concerned as the war drags on, Mr. Lynch says, adding that Mr. Graham appears to be on the side of prolonging rather than ending the fight. People are tired of him getting the United States into endless, needless wars, he said in an interview. Abby Zilch, a spokesperson for Mr. Graham, says Mr. Lynch is a perpetually failed candidate who will say anything for attention. Mr. Lynch, she said, says in an email, rejects Mr. Trump's agenda and wants more Massies in Congress who relentlessly oppose the president, referring to Kentucky GOP Representative Tom Massie, who lost his primary in May to a Trump-endorsed opponent and who has strongly opposed the Iran war. Mr. Trump himself calls Mr. Lynch a lunatic after the candidate expressed support for both Mr. Massie and former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who resigned from Congress in January after a falling out with Mr. Trump. Mr. Lynch said he was praising the two lawmakers' conservative voting records, not their opposition to Mr. Trump, whom he has described as one of the greatest presidents we've ever had. Mr. Lynch pleaded guilty in 1984 to cocaine trafficking and was treated for drug addiction. Pro-Graham groups have highlighted his drug arrests in ads. He insists that his long-shot campaign is getting traction, despite being heavily outspent by an incumbent with a substantial war chest and national networks of donors. The winner of the Republican primary is expected to face Annie Andrews, a pediatrician who is dominating the Democratic primary race. In 2020, Mr. Graham easily defeated Jamie Harrison, a former state Democratic Party chairman who raked in tens of millions of dollars for his campaign, mostly from out-of-state donors and left-leaning national groups. An interventionist record. Other critics on the right have cast Mr. Graham as a warmonger who isn't focused on his state. This spring, Mr. Graham found himself the target of tabloid mockery, with the outlet TMZ publishing viral photos of the 70-year-old senator, who is unmarried and has no children, at Disney World as the United States was waging a military campaign abroad and contending with a government shutdown at home. In March, after Mr. Graham publicly urged the administration to occupy Iran's Karg Island and invoke the capture of Iwo Jima during World War II, Republican Senator Nancy Mace, who is running for governor in South Carolina, rebuked him on social media. Lindsey Graham needs to be removed from the Situation Room. I don't want to hear one word from a guy with no kids, desperately sending our sons and daughters into war on the ground in Iran, Ms. Mace wrote. He later reversed course on seizing Karg Island, saying its oil facilities could be destroyed from the air. Still, many Republican voters here say the decision to go to war with Iran was Mr. Trump's, and that's enough for them. Mr. Trump wants, quote, to protect America, says Frank Webb, a voter in Fort Mill who works in retail. He says gas prices went up more under President Joe Biden, and he doesn't fault Mr. Trump for recent price spikes. As for Mr. Graham, he's got a great relationship with our president, and that's kind of like the key to the game, Mr. Webb said. I mean, having him appear in the White House is always great. A three-decade rise. Mr. Graham was first elected to the U.S. House in 1994 when Republicans won control of Congress for the first time in 40 years, part of then-Speaker Newt Gingrich's contract with America. In 2002, he won the Senate seat previously held by Strom Thurmond, a segregationist Democrat turned Republican who was one of the longest-serving U.S. senators in history. He served for 47 years. Though he has shifted his free market conservatism to match the more protectionist Trump-era zeitgeist, when it comes to foreign policy, Mr. Graham has been a consistent hawk. He's very much someone who believes the world is a better place with a strong and robust American foreign policy, says John Seaton, who advised Mr. Graham in 2015 when he sought the GOP nomination for president, only to drop out before the first primary votes were cast. This includes his pro-Israel advocacy, a stance that has become increasingly unpopular with younger Republicans. Support for Israel is not a finger-in-the-wind position for him. He believes it to his core, says Mr. Seaton, who is now CEO of Echo Canyon Consulting. In an interview in March with the Post and Courier of Charleston, Mr. Graham said he wasn't deterred by naysayers when it comes to his stance on Iran or anything else. I don't need a lot of outside validation for things when I know what the hell I'm talking about. You don't have to agree with me, but I believe I know what I'm talking about, and when I convince myself of something, I'm a force to be reckoned with, he said. He told the Post and Courier that he wasn't afraid to take positions or voice opinions that opened him up to criticism, even if it led to electoral defeat. If you're scared of losing your job, you can't be a very good senator, he said. And again, this particular article was by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to jump over to the environment section of today's Monitor, just for sort of a change of pace. And the headline here reads, "In Utah, growing pushback over a city-sized data center." The Stratos project, backed by investor Kevin O'Leary, has scaled back its planned footprint near Utah's Great Salt Lake. But scientists still see big risks for the local environment. The date on this article is June 5th. It is by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. As data center disputes rage across the United States, with communities pushing back against mammoth facilities that require chunks of energy, water, and land to fuel the international artificial intelligence race, few places can compare with the debate happening in the northwestern corner of Utah. Locals and scientists say the Stratos project, backed by celebrity Canadian investor Kevin O'Leary of Shark Tank fame, stands out not just for the way in which it was approved, but also for its size. Initially planned to sprawl across 40,000 acres, the size of Washington, D.C., in Box Elder County, the project would consume up to 9 gigawatts of electricity, which is more than double what the state of Utah uses per year. Mr. O'Leary has boasted that it would be one of the biggest data centers in the world. Opposition has grown over the past few weeks after the approval process was fast-tracked by a special state commission called MIDA, Utah's Military Installation Development Authority, and unanimously approved by the three-person county commission in early May. Many locals say they have had no opportunity for input. In response, Republican officials in the state have softened their previous full-blown support for the project. Governor Spencer Cox issued an executive order last week requiring careful consideration of data centers' environmental impacts. Utah's Senate President Stuart Adams, who chaired MIDA, called for a 75% reduction in Stratos acreage footprint in a letter to Mr. O'Leary on Monday. Despite initially calling Mr. Adams' request for such a haircut of the project outrageous, Mr. O'Leary announced Thursday that he would cut the footprint of the project in half, removing about 20,000 acres from his plans. But thus far, this has done little to quell pushback. Scientists say a compromise over acreage does little to alleviate concerns over the environmental impacts that such a project would bring to the Great Salt Lake Basin, a nationally renowned site facing a mega drought. It's performative, says Robert Davies, a physics professor at Utah State University, of the promised acreage reduction. He has concluded from his own calculations that the 9-gigawatt project would only require 5,000 to 7,000 acres. Even still, he says, the energy usage would be 20 times more than what is used by hyperscale data centers. Dr. Davies has also found that such a project could raise the nighttime temperature in the area by up to 12 degrees, which he says would be transformative. Among other impacts, that sort of temperature rise would suppress nighttime condensation levels that the already water-stricken ecosystem relies on. This would be one of the largest single-site heat sources on the entire planet, he adds, and that includes volcanoes. Although he is only committed to a reduction in square acreage and not energy consumption, Mr. O'Leary told the Salt Lake Tribune that the project will no longer be the largest in the world. That's off the table, he said. In his letter to Mr. Adams, Mr. O'Leary cited incorrect assumptions for all the alarm around the project, and he has previously claimed that opposition groups were backed by the Chinese Communist Party. But at the same time, Mr. O'Leary has acknowledged the real political pressures on the ground in Utah, where the Box Elder County project has become an issue even within Mr. Adams' own GOP primary contest. Mr. Adams did this for political reasons, Mr. O'Leary told the Salt Lake Tribune. He had to. What other choice did he have? He has to answer to all these people. And again, this particular article was by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. Finally, here's something from a new section in the Christian Science Monitor, the Home Forum. The headline is Discovery at the Drive-In. The date is May 8th. It is this little point is by Zachary Prisistoup, who's a contributor. On a bright and dewy spring morning, I was meeting a friend for a walk around nearby Burke Lake Park and stopped by a McDonald's to pick up a couple of Egg McMuffins for our breakfast. I pulled into the parking lot from the north and east towards the drive-thru. I had company, a big tough guy, beard, hunting gear, don't tread on me type, in a big tough truck, oversized wheels, mud flaps, approaching from the south. I was clearly the next in line, but the back of his truck was jutting out into a side street, so I motioned for him to go ahead. His engine roared as if he were taking off on a street race. The truck lurched forward 10 feet and then rocked back as he hit the brakes. Glad I let him go, I thought. He placed his order, I placed mine, and pulled up to the window to pay. As I presented my credit card, the woman at the register put up a hand. She motioned toward the truck ahead and said with a smile and a shrug, "He paid for you." Surprised, I opened my car door and shouted a quick, "Hey, thank you." The big tough guy flashed a thumbs up in the side view mirror and then rumbled off to meet the rest of his day. It was a really nice moment. But did this brief interaction over Egg McMuffins at a McDonald's drive-thru restore my faith in humanity? Actually, yeah, it kind of did. It reminded me that despite what we see on the news and social media, where everyone is a fire-breathing extremist of some sort, most people out there are pretty friendly folks. It reminded me of all the times in my life, in big and small ways, at home and abroad, when I depended on the kindness of strangers and they came through. It reminded me not to judge a book by its cover. If that's an overused phrase, it's probably because we need to be reminded of it all the time. I met my friend at the lake. We unwrapped our free English muffins, steam rising into the air, and saw the sun lighting up the new green foliage. It was a beautiful morning. And with that, we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you spending some of your time with me listening to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I will be back at the end of the week with more from the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you for listening.